From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Students are heading back to school. The yellow buses you see on county roads, ever wonder why you don't spot them in Baltimore? It's one of the growing number of big cities that rely on public transit for school. We ride the bus with students to try to understand their complicated commutes. Then how is something as tangible as our sense of touch linked to something as intangible as our emotions? That's one of the questions Tom Hall asks Johns Hopkins neuroscientist David Linden as they discuss his book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Plus, we visit Loch Raven Reservoir to check out the area's wildlife and learn how it inspired a local photographer's book for young readers called The Swan at Loch Raven. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Students are heading back to school in most of the suburbs this week, in the city of Baltimore next week. A good time to listen again to our story about how kids get to school. The yellow bus is a symbol of public schools, but in many big cities, tens of thousands of students make their way to and from school without that icon. They navigate public transit. In fact, more school systems are switching from the yellow bus to public transit. But getting those kids to school on time can be difficult, especially in Baltimore, where middle and high school students can apply to attend any school in the city, regardless of how close or far it is from home. In coming months, Baltimore schools may have the data to make smarter decisions about this complex issue. After we aired this story last spring, a few high schools started using a new digital pass that enables city schools to collect information on transit patterns. Here's the story Jonna McCone reported in February.
Asia, I'm picking you up.
Sharon Roland Glenn is waking up her sleepy daughter, Asia, as her family gets ready for school on a chilly early February morning.
My name is Laurel Glenn. I go to Digital Harbor High School and I woke up at 5:30.
Today I'm following Laurel, the older sister, on her daily commute from West Baltimore to her school in Federal Hill downtown. We head out the front door. A few vacant stop blocks of large row houses. A white shotgun church anchors a corner of the quiet street.
We are going to the 15 bus stop. It's around the corner from my house. I would have took you to the 23, but it's too unpredictable and I have to get to school early today. Well, on time.
The sun isn't quite out yet. The streets are mostly empty as we wait for the bus across from a convenience store and a liquor shop.
It's two of them coming. That means one of them is late. Someone running for the bus. Because if you miss this one, Lord knows what time you'll get where you're going.
Several years ago, Sue Fothergill, now senior policy associate at the nonprofit Attendance Works, started a working group to examine attendance problems in Baltimore. She said transportation quickly became the focus.
When you talk to young people in any part of the city about what are the challenges they face about getting to school every day, transportation comes up again and again, whether you're talking to a kid at Patterson High School, if you're talking to a kid at Baltimore School for the Arts.
She says problems have gotten more complicated now that families can pick which schools they want to attend.
For some young people, they're traveling pretty great distances from their homes to their schools because that's the school they want to go to. But then our transportation system, the MTA, is not necessarily aligned to or purposefully designed to help to move kids from where they live to the schools that they've chosen.
The bus system in Baltimore, of course, is actually quite old, dates back to pre-MTA days to the Baltimore Transit Company.
That's Michael Walk. He works in the Office of Service Development at the Maryland Transit Administration, or MTA.
A lot of the lines designed as they are today are really focused on sort of the downtown core. A lot of the service funnels people into that area, where a large portion of the jobs and opportunities are.
And most schools aren't in downtown Baltimore.
So the students themselves, you know, usually have to make a transfer or two to get from the neighborhood that they're starting from to whatever school they're ending at.
MTA is trying to improve service through its bus network improvement project, but federal law prohibits public bus services from making changes to their bus lines that exclusively serve the needs of schools. So the MTA is limited in the changes it can make. Again, Michael Walk.
And that sort of gets into the catch-22 about public transit serving as the main school bus for a school system. Public transit is designed around as many markets as possible. Then the fact that students need to take that same system to get to schools, you know, we don't change where a route goes because of school alignments, but we do offer what we call tripper service.
So on select bus lines, routes deviate to go closer to schools or run more frequently when lots of kids are on the buses in the mornings and afternoons. After the number 15 bus takes us downtown, Laurel and I catch our second bus. In a few more stops, things get crowded. A stream of students boards.
They're still trying to get on. They don't want to be late. The bus is packed, and we just passed a lot of students on the bus stop.
They couldn't fit on it.
Yes.
Which causes a ripple effect. The stuffed bus leaves kids waiting at the next few stops, and then there's a fight. Laurel sat quietly with her blue and white striped backpack on her lap. She's almost always on time. But for other students in the city, getting to school regularly, much less on time, is a challenge. Lateness has been such a problem at Digital Harbor, Laurel's school, that late students have to scan their finger on what Laurel calls this fingerprint thing. After three late arrivals, students get detention. Sue Fothergill says kids who are regularly late are more likely to be chronically absent.
If a student is chronically late and missing their first period class and falling behind academically there to the point where it becomes really difficult to catch up, it affects their overall capacity to stay focused in the rest of their classes as well. We know from the data that there is a relationship between the late kids and the absent kids. And we also know from the data that the likelihood that you're going to go on to graduate precipitously declines.
According to a 2010 study, 25% of students miss more than 20 days of school in Baltimore. Nationwide, groups are working to better understand attendance, but there's still very little data on how kids get where they're going and how transportation relates to attendance. Baltimore City Schools and MTA could not give me information on average commute times for students, the number of times students need to make transfers, nor whether any high schools are more than a half mile from a bus stop. The only data I could get was ridership numbers by stop and time intervals. Again, Michael Walk of MTA.
You know, actually, we haven't looked at that data ourselves. You know, we have a good idea about what bus routes are used by students could hypothetically look at the data to see if students are making transfers between, but not in particular to look at that. Based on what we've been told by the school or by students themselves, you know, some cases it might be half an hour, some cases 45 minutes, depending.
Of the handful of students I spoke with at two high schools, many said their commutes take them longer than 45 minutes. Walk says next year MTA will conduct a survey to figure out where bus riders are coming from and going to help prioritize routes. Students can also text their complaints to the MTA. About 10 to 15 kids do so each week, mostly for issues like lateness and crowding.
We kind of sit in the middle of both worlds. Yes. You know, the best line of communication is through the administration. So, like, if there's an issue where kids are unable to get to school or leave school because of some sort of transit issue, it's best that that's communicated to the school leadership, the principal. So that's part of the official process, is the school puts in a request into the headquarters, BCPS headquarters, who then compiles those requests and send them to us.
Michael Walk had a few examples of these requests, but I asked Baltimore City Schools and communication staff several times to cite a situation in which a change to transit resulted from a school or teacher complaint. I still have not heard back.
It's 7:47, and in about 10 minutes, we'll be late.
Back at Digital Harbor with Laurel, an administrator there told me transportation isn't an issue. Students just have to wake up on time. As students poured into the main entrance, I asked them about their commutes.
Opposites start to show, where those who live in the neighborhood, they're easy to get here on time. They can just simply just walk across the street or have their parents come, whereas people like for myself, we have to catch the bus. And see, for my parents go to work early, so that's another main factor for me having to make sure I have to get here on time.
I take 2 buses to school.
How long is your ride on each bus?
Like 45 minutes.
On each bus?
Yeah.
Are you late to school very much with that commute?
I'm late to school all the time.
How do you usually get to school?
The subway and then a bus. It's not that long. I would say like a good like 45 minutes.
Sometimes the buses don't even stop at the stops. They just automatically just go past you and they see you right there, and that's not right. You just sitting here, all you doing is trying to catch the bus and just come to school, do what you need to do, and go home.
I've been here, this is my 4th year now, and it takes me 2 hours to get here every day.
That last student you heard, Destiny, it takes her 2 hours to get to City Neighbors High School in Northeast Baltimore. At her school, students, teachers, and parents organized surveys and worked with the MTA to move the bus stop just around the corner from the school to make things safer for students. Danique Dolly is principal there. He spent time walking with his students to and from the bus stops.
I had students who had actually fought on buses. And then if you're fighting on a bus and you see this person all the time, they know when to try to get you. So we try to alleviate all of that by having the buses closest to us, so we know that the students getting on the bus are our students.
Safety on the way to the stops is also an issue.
My school is near Harford Road, but if the students took the quickest route, they would have to pretty much cross the street like that game of Frogger, where you're pretty much dodging and going back and forth to get across the street. We have no clue as to what the students deal with. We definitely don't have a clue because we don't take public transportation. I don't take it, I'll be honest. I know most of the teachers don't take it. So how are we speaking for the students or the youth when we're not the youth on the buses every day? We don't get up in the morning and have to figure out, you know, the best route and where to sit and all that and deal with people trying to rob you every now and then. We don't deal with that, but the students do.
Dolly tells me transportation is a barrier, just like other hardships that keep students from getting to school each day, like family obligations or falling behind in coursework. But he is quick to say that if students want to be at school, they'll find a way to get there.
My attendance rate is in the 90s. I have some students that take an hour and a half to 2 hours to get here, but they know the value of being here, so they'll do what it takes to get here. And they do that knowing that transportation will be that slight obstacle and challenge of the day and figuring out the best route for themselves or the best time to get here. But is it a challenge? Yes. Is it a challenge that can be handled, that we can overcome? Yeah. Because if the school is interesting and the student really wants to get to the school, they're going to come. And I have plenty of examples of that.
A group called Hack Baltimore is using data to get a better sense of students' needs, specifically those of homeless students, and several developers recently released a bus tracking app to replace MTA's clunky web interface. But without more data, and relying mostly on teachers to communicate the issues, it seems part of school choice means a heavy transportation burden for some students. By the way, Laurel made it to school a few minutes early. Reporting from several bus lines in Baltimore, I'm Jonna McCone.
We've got a link to more research about school transit at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Laurel Glenn will be attending University of Maryland Eastern Shore this fall. She'll be living on campus, so she's not especially worried about her commute. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning, a touchy subject. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Hi, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. David Linden is a neuroscientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the former editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. David has written several terrific books about our brains and how they work. His first book, The Accidental Mind, explored how our brains evolved over time to make us capable of things like romantic love and belief in God. In a book called The Compass of Pleasure, he argues that we are hardwired to seek pleasure in a variety of forms. And in both of those books, he writes about the inextricable link between our minds and our hearts. Last January, David published his latest book, in which he takes up the subject of touch. And again, he proposes that the many ways in which we experience touch, from a tender caress to a painful injury, are all tied in one way or another to our emotions. The book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. He joined me in the studio in February to talk about this fun and fascinating read. And a note to listeners with children nearby, we did talk a little bit about sex. And right at the beginning of the book, David Linden makes the case that of all of our senses, touch may be the most essential. Having a sense of touch is simply not optional.
I think we tend to discount touch because we can't imagine it not being there. We can close our eyes and imagine being blind, and we can plug our ears and imagine being deaf, and we can pinch our nose shut, but you can't turn off your touch sense. And it's true, so if a child is born blind, they can develop and have a normal mind, normal brain, normal body. Same if you're born deaf, you can have a great life. But if you're born with a sense of touch, but you are deprived of loving touch as a newborn and a toddler, as happened in Romanian orphanages in the 1980s and 90s, well, then a complete disaster unfolds.
Yeah, they actually have physical symptoms later in life. I mean, they have gastrointestinal problems, and they have psychological developmental problems. I mean, it's really severe, isn't it? Yeah,
it's quite severe. And the bad news is that it doesn't go away as you grow up. So these kids who didn't receive loving touch early in life, they develop self-soothing, compulsive rocking motions and attachment disorders. Their growth is slowed. Their cognitive development is reduced. But then, as adults, when we track them, they have high incidences of obesity, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive. Disorder, immune system dysfunction. Touch is not optional for early human development the way the other senses are.
And it's interesting, you observe that metaphors about touch really pervade our rhetoric. We talk about, you know, being touched by her kindness, or he rubs me the wrong way. I mean, we have these phrases that actually, you know, relate directly to what things feel like on our skin.
Well, that's right. And we're so used to using them, we don't even think about them as having to do with touch at all. When we say my feelings to mean my tender emotions, there is a reason why it's my feelings and not my sightings or my smellings. I mean, this seems silly. And it seems, I think some of your listeners might say, well, but this is just a trick of modern day English. Who really cares that at this moment in time, in this one language, we happen to use that metaphor? But it's not just a trick of modern day English. In English, it's been around as long as we have recorded English, back to the 13th century. And we know that the constructions like I'm touched or my feelings are present in many languages, not just languages even of the Indo-European language group.
David Linden, the new book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. So you talk about touch being intrinsically emotional. What does that mean?
Well, what it means, and this is a rather remarkable discovery, it turns out that if we look in our brains, we have two different streams of information coming from all the touch receptors, which are different kinds of nerve endings in our skin, some for heat and cold and pain and itch and vibration and texture and all these different things. And they go to our brain, and then we have two centers. One of them is there to just give us the facts of touch. Where on my body am I being touched? In what fashion? How intensely? And there's a completely separate region of the brain called the posterior insula that's involved in giving touch its emotional tone. It's what makes pain feel emotionally bad. It's what makes a caress or an orgasm feel emotionally good. And we think of these things as being intrinsic properties of pain or caress or orgasm. But that's just a trick our brain plays on us by having the fact analysis and the emotional analysis of touch happening at the same time.
So you say that all sensations, including touch, are in the service of action. Right? So they're not reporting on the outside world, but they're making inferences about what to expect from the outside world.
That's right. So our senses are not built to give us the lowdown. They're not built to give us the most accurate representation of the external world at all. As a result of our human experience and as a result of lots of evolutionary history, our senses cherry pick the data from the outside world to feed to us. Then, before we are ever conscious of it, they blend it with expectations about how the world works and with our emotions. So there is no sensation without emotion. Let me give you an example, right? If you like tea and you like coffee, and you pick up your mug and you're expecting coffee and you get a sip of tea, your experience of that at that moment is very, very different than if you were expecting tea and you got tea.
Yeah. And this business of the outside world and the touch that we experience from outside and the touch that we experience that's self-generated is interesting. We can't tickle ourselves. And self-inflicted pain is somehow less painful than pain inflicted by somebody else. Why is that?
Well, it's part of a general theme. In our brains, we're hardwired to discount sensations that result from our own movements, our own actions. And it happens in all senses. But just imagine walking down the street. You're walking down the street, you're swinging your limbs, and your clothes are moving against your body, but you don't even think about that. You don't even notice it. Yet, if you were still and then your clothes moved against your body in that same way, suddenly you would be saying, oh, who's groping me? What's going on? You'd be very attentive to it. And so when you go to tickle yourself, your brain is sending commands to the muscles in your arm and in your fingers to make the tickling motion. But a copy of that command is also going to the part of the brain called the cerebellum. And from there, it is inhibiting the part of your brain that feels the touch sensation and damping it down. And that damping is why we can't tickle ourselves unless you have damage to your cerebellum, which interrupts that dampening circuit.
And you talk about some cases in which that is the case, and in which patients report that. Yeah.
Right. It can happen with cerebellar damage. It can also happen in a subset of schizophrenics as well,
yeah,
possibly also because of cerebellar damage.
And all the all the sensations, including touch, are interrelated, right? So touch is just as interrelated to the others. I mean, you talk about how the context of touch really matters. I mean, if someone gives you a shoulder squeeze, if that's your boss coming up behind you in your cubicle, that's one thing. If it's your lover, you know, at dinner, that's another thing. So the context, the social context of how and by whom we're touched matters a lot.
Oh, it matters enormously. And I think the important thing to realize, imagine this, do this mental exercise. You're with your sweetheart, you're feeling good, connected, loving, and your sweetheart puts his or her arm around you and gives you a squeeze. Now imagine the very same squeeze from the very same person, identical, the same place on your skin, the same pressure, but now it's in the middle of an argument and it's not resolved. Well, that feels totally differently. And it's not just that it feels the same, but then you think about it differently, it actually feels differently. And the reason it does is because the higher areas of the brain that are involved in computing social context are sending messages to the somatosensory cortex, the part of the brain that actually creates the feeling, and changing that.
So the fourth chapter of the book is called Sexual Touch. And I'll admit, David, you had me at sexual. You did.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about the hard wires that we all have and then how that can perhaps even dictate our preferences in bed. You quote Naomi Wolf from a book she wrote called Vagina, A Cultural History. Is it true that we are sort of hardwired, our preferences in bed are somewhat hardwired and predetermined?
In truth, we don't know. So Naomi Wolf made a hypothesis, which is a reasonable one. And she pointed out that if you look at autopsy tissue, for example, of women, you find that the innervation of the genitals is not precisely the same from woman to woman. Some women might have a few more fibers in their clitoris and less in their cervix, some more in their labia, some more in their vagina, some more around the anus or the rectum. And so she hypothesizes, and this is a reasonable guess, maybe that variation has something to do with people's individual sexual likes and dislikes, and could be the same for men, who also aren't precisely hardwired in that innervation. But the truth is we don't know. And the reason is because these nerves are very small. They're too small for medical scanning machines. And so we can't just interview people about what they like in bed and then take a picture of their genitals and see how it correlates. We have cadavers, and most of the time we don't have interviews with people before they died asking what they liked in bed. So it's a reasonable guess. I think it's almost certain that a large aspect of people's sexual likes and dislikes are not heritable and not anatomical. It's an open question whether a part of it is.
How about broadly speaking, men and women? Do we experience touch differently?
We experience touch a little bit differently. If you're talking about sexual touch, it's actually remarkable how similar it is. So there was this great study where they asked men and women to write descriptions of their orgasms. And then people were hired to take out all the, you know, words like penis and vagina that would give away whether it was a man or a woman. And then these descriptions were given to people to read, students or doctors or psychologists, sex therapists. Nobody could tell the difference between which was a male and which was a female orgasm. And the same thing is true if you do brain scanning. If you do brain scanning in men and women while they're having an orgasm, they're only very subtle differences that you find. The pattern of activation is remarkably similar.
I really don't want to ask you how one does brain scanning of people while they're having an orgasm. Are there in fact studies that have happened like that?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, most of these studies are done in the Netherlands.
I see.
And
leave it to them.
It's a deeply unsexy situation.
One would imagine.
You know, your head, you have to think about it. Your head is strapped down because your brain can't jiggle. You have an IV in your arm to inject the radioactive water. You have a probe in your thuchus. It's not a romantic scene at all. And then there's some geek like me in a white coat with a clipboard staring at you.
Yeah, just in time for Valentine's Day, ladies and gentlemen, a new idea. You talk about how social touch reinforces cooperation and loyalty. I'm fascinated by a study they did with the National Basketball Association, finding that players who do celebratory touches, you know, chest bumps and stuff, early in the season, actually that's associated with higher win streaks and, win percentages later in the season. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's great. So this was a terrific study done at Berkeley by Dr. Keltner's group. And they got people to score all these NBA games. And it's just as you said, where there was more, they scored the butt pats and the high fives and the chest bumps and the high tens and all the things that people do to celebrate. And they found not only did the teams that celebrated more early in the season do better later, but when you analyzed their play, they played in a more team-like manner. In other words, a player who might have a poor shot but a chance at it would be more likely to pass off to his teammate who had a better shot rather than hogging the glory for themselves.
You talk about the emotional component of pain, and you talk about a disorder in which people are what's called pain asymbolic, where they don't have an emotional resonance with pain, and that can actually lead to all sorts of problems. And we're running out of time, but is there a way to attenuate pain? Is there a way to lessen one's sense of pain?
Well, you can, for chronic pain, you can lessen it with obviously with drugs, but more interestingly with practices like open presence meditation. There's a positive feedback loop between chronic pain and anxiety. And if you can break that loop with processes that reduce anxiety, both pharmacologic and behavioral, then you can do a lot of good.
All right, well, it's fascinating stuff. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
David Linden, he's a neuroscientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the former editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. His latest book is called Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. We spoke last February. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. A cacophony of cicadas greeted me over the weekend when I visited Loch Raven Reservoir, just north of Baltimore City. If you listen closely, you might be able to hear a goose honking in the background. Or maybe not. Those bugs are loud. Back in January, I visited Loch Raven with photographer David Simpson. Then, temperatures were in the 30s, ice covered much of the water, and the only sounds you could hear were those of geese and seagulls. David Simpson had joined me to talk about his then newly published book for children called The Swan at Loch Raven. It features pictures of a particularly majestic bird he encountered while boating on the reservoir. This morning, we'll listen back to some of that conversation, starting with David's description of how he first encountered the swan.
I was just motoring along. I attached two small battery motors to my kayak so I can be silent, so I don't frighten the wildlife. And I'm motoring along as slowly as I can, approaching a blue heron. And all of a sudden, a freight train type of noise I hear to the back of me, which I've never heard before on Loch Raven. And it ended up being this swan. Both of his huge wings were both sides of my ears. From the back, he flew over top of me, just grazing the top of my head. And he crashed in front of my kayak.
How close was he to you?
He was certainly close enough that I could feel the wind from his wings, and whether he actually physically touched me, I'm not really sure.
It certainly felt like he touched you, whether or not
I'm sure he touched the top of my head, but he certainly didn't hurt me.
So you weren't out looking for the swan. The swan just sort of overtook you.
Yeah, a complete surprise. He splashed in front of me, a big crash, which is in the book. And then he started looking at me, and he wanted me to follow him. I later found out that he was protecting his family. So he was leading me to the right, and the family was to the left. But instead of following him, I made a full circle, and he took off. And he did exactly the same thing again. He buffeted the top of my head with his wings, crashed again. And hence the reason I got the photographs. I would have never gotten those photographs had I not done it a second time. All this took place probably within 5 to 10 minutes.
Once you had those photographs, did you immediately think of putting them into a book?
I didn't really think about it for probably 6 months to a year. And I struggled with a good way about telling kids to be careful of beautiful things and to respect nature, to respect animals, and try to figure out a way to tell a really nice story.
You worked on that story with your daughter, who teaches kindergarten and first grade. What did you do to make that story accessible to kids who are just learning how to read?
I tried to make it that an early reader has words in the book that are big and block letters, and the mom reads the smaller letters, and as the kids get a little older, they can read the entire book. But it's a good beginning book to read to a small child so they can learn how to read.
That's David Simpson. His new book is The Swan at Loch Raven, a book geared at younger kids. I'm Nathan Sterner, and you're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Let's wander over to the point here. Try not to slip on the ice. It's hard to believe how close we are to Baltimore City here at Loch Raven.
You can make a left coming into this park and see things like this, which is probably 30 or 40 geese, or you can make a right and go to the highway.
I come to Loch Raven a lot, usually hiking along the trails that surround the reservoir. on your kayak, you have access to places that I've never been. We're overlooking the island that's called Goose Island or Feather Island. Have you actually set foot on it?
Oh, yeah. I've gone all over this area. The reason I used battery motors is because I can get to places that you can't physically get to and get back in time. If you're in a kayak, you can't make it 2 miles and come back. And then there's weather. It can get very touchy out there in a kayak.
Have you ever been stuck out in the middle of...
Yes, I have. And that's the reason I did motors, because I couldn't get back.
Describe what happened when you got stuck in the middle of the reservoir on a bad
day. It's very scary. It's very scary. It's deep, and it's much bigger than you think. I mean, we're looking out over here, and we're seeing an island, and we're seeing a shore, and everything seems like it's in close proximity. But I wouldn't want to swim from the fishing center to that island. It would be probably a mile and a half. And it's very deep. It can be completely serene and glass-like. And it can be very, very choppy as well. I was doing a larger book a few years ago that was a more like a photographic essay of the beauty of Loch Raven. And in that process, I photographed for about 3 years, and I couldn't stop. I enjoyed it so much, I continued to come out even after the book was published.
Can you talk about your process for making images of Loch Raven? What goes through your mind as you're photographing the wildlife here?
Well, it's sort of getting up as early as possible in the morning. Seeing the fog is the best way to approach it. It's not even mist, it's like a fog. There's something about the temperature of the water and the temperature of the air and how it produces a mist. And early in the morning, 5, 6 in the morning, it's just the most unbelievable light. You know, it's meditative. It's a wonderful thing to experience, especially from the boat. The reason I did the book was the amount of people that fly over the bridges of Loch Raven and never bother to get on the water.
The pictures that you took for this book, The Swan, were all taken from the kayak.
Yes, every one was taken from the kayak.
But your other book, you took pictures from other vantage points?
I did. The idea was to completely do it from the kayak. I thought that would be really interesting to get people, motivate people to get out on the water here. But what happened is the snow was so beautiful, and the ice and the different seasons. You can't really put a kayak in here in the snow. And it's a disservice not to photograph this place in the winter.
It is beautiful.
Yeah. You could photograph all day today.
The sounds of Loch Raven Reservoir back in January when I spoke with photographer David Simpson about his book, The Swan at Loch Raven. David Simpson will be speaking about the book in October at Loch Raven United Methodist Church, and in November he'll be showing off his newest work at Live Again Gallery and Art Bar in Cambridge. There's more online at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. And you can explore Loch Raven anytime. We'll put a link to a trail map on our website as well. For Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast, I'm Nathan Sterner.
Maryland Morning is an original production of
Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this bleak day in Maryland history, 1814, Maryland militias were routed at the Battle of Bladensburg in Prince George's County, opening the way for British troops to march into Washington, D.C. and torch the U.S. Capitol and the White House. Maryland redeemed itself 3 weeks later in the Battle of Baltimore. We're back Wednesday. Please join us.